From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll talk with former NASA shuttle astronaut Wendy Lawrence ahead of her appearance here this Sunday in Milwaukee. Then Paul Salcini's latest novel returns to Tuscany and focuses on the Garfagnana, a region known for its supernatural occurrences.
It's not only so beautiful, but it also has this eerie kind of reputation. Things happen there.
Radio Chipstone explores the 19th century practice of object lessons, and Wisconsin natives and filmmakers Drew Roses and Nick Summer share the story behind their new web series, Shangri-La.
And that was really what we kind of want to tap into with the show, is sort of take the mythology of Shangri-La, the original Tibetan utopia, and flip it on its head and say, okay, what about the myth of Hollywood and that mirage?
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. 59 years ago, humans first left Earth, and 50 years ago, we landed on the moon. Since then, we've orbited the Earth, sent rovers to Mars, and sent people to live on the International Space Station. It won't be too long before humans make that long journey to Mars to begin our extraterrestrial colonization. Wendy Lawrence is one of the people who has contributed to the collective knowledge that will make that journey possible. The former NASA astronaut is also a retired U.S. Navy captain, a pilot, and an engineer. She'll be in Milwaukee this Sunday to give a talk about her career. It's part of a three-day-long event called the Under One Moon Festival, which is taking place in the Third Ward. We reached Lawrence by phone ahead of her visit here, and she explained that she was first selected to be a shuttle astronaut.
I arrived at NASA in 1992 when NASA was really getting good at figuring out how to fly the space shuttle and fly it regularly. So I finished my initial training flow as an astronaut candidate, and then actually before I finished, got assigned to my first mission. So I felt very, very privileged to be at NASA at that point in time.
We no longer have the shuttle, and we depend on the Russians now to get astronauts to and from the International Space Station. During the time that you were flying those shuttle missions, was there an idea that this was going to go away?
Well, I think in that business, you're always looking at what you want to do next, because when you come from the world of aviation, you understand that you're only going to get so many flight hours out of whatever it is you're operating. And so you're always thinking about, what is it that we want to do next? Even when I got to NASA at 92, there was a strong desire to do what we did do during Apollo. We had been in low Earth orbit for a while, but all of our sights still were set much farther away. We needed to do the International Space Station because you need to get experience with humans being in space for much longer periods of time. Not only do the astronauts need that experience, the people who work in mission control, the people who plan the mission, need that experience. And so I'm all for going back to the moon because I think like an engineer. I want to go test everything out on the moon, but I don't want that to be the final destination. I think we need to continue to push the boundaries. Mars is doable, and so that's where you set your sights next. But the path, in my opinion, definitely needs to go through the moon.
I have a regular segment here on the show with a local astronomer, astrophysicist, and we talk about space travel, space life quite a lot because of so many of the problems that haven't yet been solved. Like, what do we do about long-term radiation, and what do we do about long-term weightlessness and what that does to the human body? You're retired now, but you were very actively involved in it at the time. When you look at what NASA and scientists are doing now, are you hopeful we're going to get to Mars?
Yes, I am. Back to radiation. Still a big problem. There's a type of radiation called galactic cosmic radiation that is very, very difficult to protect the astronauts from because we're talking about bits of atoms, so particles with a very high amount of energy. And to effectively shield your spacecraft from that, that's the technical challenge that still hasn't quite been solved. we're making good progress on it. But that one really, to me, is probably the top technical challenge. Because we've had astronauts now on the International Space Station for so many years and spending longer amounts of time there, we've gotten a good understanding of what to do to keep them from impacting their bone health and losing muscle mass and muscle strength. Exercise is the key. Fortunately, astronauts have to do a lot of it, but that seems to be working quite well. So when we head off to Mars and we have a level of gravity, will that help? Absolutely. Is it going to be enough? That's still an unknown.
The science fiction kid in me, of course, wants to go. I mean, I just think it's fabulous. I want us to get out there and, you know, be the Star Trek that actually was only on television. You know, I want that to actually be reality. But I know,
me too.
But I know there's so much that we have to do that, of course, a television show didn't have to do. You just kind of create the world and say, well, this is how it works. And then there's also the psychological aspects of long-term space travel.
And I think people are going to look at the International Space Station and say they did a couple of really great things. One, it showed that countries across the world can work together and be very, very successful on ambitious projects that they set their mind to. It is absolutely doable. But I think from a mission planning point of view and a mission support point of view, one of the most important lessons we've learned is how to support the crews better psychologically. Because NASA, with its first group of astronauts all being test pilots, you can definitely think right stuff here, that was very much discounted. But we've seen that it is critically important for keeping the crews healthy and happy.
So in the early days, there was very much that military mindset of just suck it up?
Oh, yeah. That's an understatement.
Well, that's good to know that that's changed somewhat. Do you feel like it's been enough?
My last job in the astronaut office was supporting the first 14 crews that went up to the space station. And, you know, I would say probably never enough, but certainly so much better than it was, and probably more than adequate. Technology, wonderful. We take advantage of it. We use it to connect the crews with their families. There's a telephone on the space station. If they want to call Earth, they can. And so that creates that sense of connection because they don't feel like, well, I'm not able to talk to anybody until I get to Sunday. I can email, but if I really wanted just to pick up the phone and have a two-way conversation, I can do that. What's going to be fascinating, though, is when we send those crews to Mars. And when that two-way conversation is no longer an option, psychological support for those crews, I think, is going to be quite challenging. So hopefully we've learned enough from the Russians with their extensive space station history, with our own operations on board the International Space Station. Hopefully we've learned enough, but I hope people do not discount the challenges that time delay and communication for that first crew that goes to Mars.
Yeah, I'm sitting here nodding. You can't see me, but I was thinking the same thing, that we're not going to be able to have a telephone on whatever spacecraft that is, and we hope there's going to be connection once the landing happens, but again, it's going to be delayed by how much? How long would that delay be?
It depends on the relationship of the Earth's alignment with Mars, but generally, you know, you could have, I think, up to a 20-minute time delay round trip. So it really changes from a crew's point of view when you're training with your flight control team. It changes how you're going to interact because we got spoiled on the shuttle. We're still spoiled on the station. If I have a question, I can just call the ground. Somebody else can look it up for me and get me back an answer in a very short period of time. Oftentimes, they already have the answer, and it's an immediate response. You don't aren't going to be able to do that on Mars. So if you have an emergency, that crew got to figure it out on their own. They have to be pretty much entirely self-sufficient.
And that's tough over time.
Yes, yes, because invariably, if you're operating a new spacecraft, you realize we don't know everything there is to know. Even though we sat and we pondered and we what if, there's always something that surprises you. And that crew, when that moment happens, they're going to have to look at one another and say, between all of us, can we figure this out?
What do you think is the optimum number of people, assuming all other things being equal, that should be on that first mission? How, you know, what's the right number so that you have enough minds working on problems like that?
Probably beyond three. I just think there's going to be so much to accomplish that there's no way that three people could learn it well enough. You know, then you start looking at spacecraft design, because landing a significant amount of mass down on Mars is not an easy problem either. That's another technological hurdle we have to figure out. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm a proponent of an odd number for decision-making, kind of back to that psychological discussion. So maybe five. You know, if you could have a crew of seven, that would be awesome. It may really stretch what you're able to do with your spacecraft lander, however, so I don't think three. I don't think it can go entirely with the Apollo model. So for now, my wag at it, I'd say maybe a crew of five.
I'm asking you to put your seeing into the future hat on, but when are we likely to see a crew making that first attempt?
Not next decade. Well, actually, that's a good question for Congress. Like, how much money are you willing to give NASA?
That's always a good question.
It really does boil down to funding, because this year being the 50th year of Apollo, some people focused on the amount of money that NASA had back then, and it was a significant part of the budget, up around 5%. Now it's less than 0.5%. So not so much the amount, it's the fact that Congress likes to change it year after year, and that's what makes your mission planning and what we're going to do, what we're how we're going to design the spacecraft, what capabilities we're going to build into it. If that amount of money changes year after year, it is very, very difficult to be successful in meeting your requirements. You have to constantly replan, and that wastes time and it wastes money. So I'd say if we can get all the presidential administrations between now and then and Congress to just commit to the amount of money, give NASA the mission like President Kennedy did, and then give them a pretty stable budget, I think 2030 time frame is very doable. There are a lot of ifs in there.
Yeah, there are. And I was going to say, do you think we have the cultural and political will that we did in the 60s to do that? I mean, everybody seemed to be, I'm sure there were naysayers, but everyone seemed to be pretty much on board in the 60s to get that to happen.
And there were different, kind of an engineering term I'll use, forcing functions involved in that. It was really more of a political contest than anything else. It's a great question. I think if we can convince people of the value from a technology perspective, then we could get that commitment. I mean, we're still talking about benefits from the Apollo program in terms of technology spinoffs. The fact that I am talking to you on my cell phone, my mobile device that has more computing power than we used in the Apollo program, actually is thanks to the Apollo program and the fact that we had to miniaturize computer components. And then smart people outside of NASA looked at that and saw applications for their businesses, their industries, and they continued that development.
Well, that leads me to the reason you're coming here and the reason, you know, we're having this conversation, which is actually you're coming to speak, but it's around what's essentially an art installation and a way of thinking and approaching the moon and space and the idea of that. And do you think things like this are important to help maybe reignite that passion that we had in the 60s for this kind of thing?
I like to quote Dr. Sally Ride in instances like this, because she said, and I think it is just so accurate, you can't be what you can't see. And yes, creating that image for young people in particular is powerful. So if we can do that through art, that is wonderful. It is necessary. Just create that spark to jumpstart their imagination, to help them see what is possible for them. So, yes, and that's why when people talk about, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math education, and they want to add in A for art, I'm all for that, because everybody learns in a different way. And if you can present the information in a variety of ways, that's more powerful. You know, a good engineer is a bit of an architect and an artist, you know, because if you're tasked to design something, you know, you want it to have a certain, yeah, well, Tesla is a good example. It's a sleek-looking car. It's pushing the engineering boundaries of electrical vehicles. So, you know, you can't just always be numbers and solving that equation. And we say form and function. So that form is the art aspect. Yes, it's got a function, but you want to have an appeal to other people as well. And that's where the form, the art, comes in, because you got to catch that person's eye.
Wendy Lawrence, it has been such a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you for your work, and we're looking forward to having you here in town.
Thank you, Bonnie. I'm looking forward to it as well. I have only ever passed through the airport, so I've had no opportunity ever to be in the downtown area of Milwaukee, so I'm very much looking forward to that.
Wendy Lawrence is a retired U.S. Navy captain, a former helicopter pilot, an engineer, and a former NASA astronaut. She will be in Milwaukee this Sunday as part of the Under One Moon pop-up festival, which is taking place in the Third Ward. There is a link to more information at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we'll chat with local author Paul Salcini about his latest book on Tuscany. You are listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. When we think of the Tuscany province in Italy, many people picture rolling hills and mountains dotted with small towns and farms. Few of us picture ghosts, ghouls, and other supernatural occurrences. But the Garfagnana region of Tuscany is known for just that, and it's this eerie reputation that inspired Paul Salcini's latest book, The Ghosts of the Garfagnana. Salcini is the author of numerous books set in Tuscany, and he'll talk more about this latest one at a Boswell Book Company event next Monday. But first, he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about why his writing always returns to Tuscany.
My father was born in a little town there, and my mother's parents were born in the same town. My mother and father met here, but both sides of my family are in that same town. So when I go to the cemetery, there's Salcini's on one side and Consani's on another, among other people, of course. And so I'm really rooted there.
Have you spent a lot of time in that area?
I visited Tuscany about 13 times, but it's always been with relatives, and so I haven't spent much time touring the place.
Now, I know this book focuses on one very specific area of Tuscany.
Correct.
What are the characteristics that really make Tuscany what it is?
Tuscany is such a beautiful area. It's on all the calendars and all the postcards, and inspires artists. Florence is the capital, and so that's the center of the Renaissance. And the area is so beautiful. It's varied. There are some flat parts, but it's also mountainous and beautiful hills. There are a lot of hill towns. It stretches to the water, and so it's so varied. It's so beautiful.
What separates Garfagnana?
Garfagnana is in the northwest corner of Tuscany, and it's unlike any other part, at least I think, of Tuscany or even of Italy. It has very high mountains. Some of them are forested. Some of them are white granite. It has rippling streams and tiny villages. And it hasn't been discovered by tourists, but except for some hikers. People just don't know about the Garfagnana. Because, as I said, it's not well populated. Barga is the center of it, I suppose. It is the biggest place, and it's not very big.
How large is Barga?
Barga?
Yeah.
Barga, I would say, is about 5,000 people.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, pretty small.
It is small. It is small, and it's, as I said, it's not very well known. But it drew me because it's not only so beautiful, but it also has this eerie kind of reputation. Things happen there, and people say that. They say that there are some very strange things happening in the Garfagnan, if they are to be believed. But there are some such things as there's a bridge that was built by the devil in the Middle Ages. It's called the Devil's Bridge, of course. There's a mountain which is reported to house a witch's coven, and where strange voices can be heard. And there's also deep in another place, there's an underground cavern where voices are heard. But the one thing that interests me is in the 1940s, a lake was created when they built a dam. And in order to create the lake, they had to evacuate a village. So the village people all moved to another place and abandoned their houses and their church and everything. And so the lake covered it all. But on cold winter nights, one can hear voices and one can hear church bells, even though the church bells were removed when they built the dam. So this is what people say, you know. And maybe they do this for effect or for tourist attraction. But it's that kind of eerie kind of atmosphere that attracted me to the Garfagnana.
Well, and your stories are all kind of haunted, mysterious stories, a real departure from some of your other work right. about Tuscany.
Yes, yes. Because of this eerie your supernatural kind of atmosphere in the Garfagnana, I wanted to write stories that reflected that. And the stories have some ghosts and some have supernatural things. One woman has a seance, another one has a crystal ball, and very strange. Oh, and there's a ghost in the theater, of course. So it's all very mysterious to me. And it was so much fun writing about this because I'd never written anything like this before.
It's very mysterious. There's some religious aspects to it. You start off with the monks, of course.
Right.
And one of the things I found interesting was just how many time periods you kind of went
yes.
into. There's a lot of time travel here.
Yeah, it does have a great span of time. It starts in the Middle Ages and ends in contemporary times. For example, in one of the last stories, a young man is singing songs from Hamilton. So that brings us up to date and where we are now.
What kind of historical research did you have to do in order to write this book? Because I have to imagine that you didn't start off
No, I didn't. I've always wanted to write about the Middle Ages, but I'd really had to do a lot of research about the Middle Ages and the whole period, the bad things that happened. There's a section about the flagellants, which were people who beat themselves in order to atone for their sins. Now, that's historically accurate. There's a part about the plague, the Black Death of the Middle Ages. So I had to research all those kinds of things, too, as background and to insert those portions into the stories.
Well, and something you've written about, of course, before is World War II and Italy.
Right.
And, you know, as I was reading this book, I thought to myself, how much has this area changed over time? You know, when we're talking about it in the Middle Ages versus, mm-hmm. you know, way later in
right.
World War II versus now, how much has it changed?
It hasn't changed a lot. At least the way it looks, it hasn't changed. People have suffered, of course, a lot. And people still remember, even after all these years, World War II, the elder people, of course. And there are monuments all over. And the effect of World War II is still on these people. And the Garfagnana suffered during this whole period because the Germans were retreating at that time from the Allies who were advancing north. And it was a bloody, bloody time when the Germans were massacring people in the villages, innocent people. And people were fleeing and hiding, and it was just a terrible, terrible time.
When you've gone there, is that something that people still talk about?
They still talk about, yeah, they do. They still talk about the war. Some of them don't. Some of them don't because the war divided people. There were the partisans and their supporters, and then there were the fascists and their supporters, and the country was really split. And it was a civil war actually that was happening in Italy until after the Mussolini capitulated, and then the Allies took over.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to this book specifically, unlike your other books, this is a collection of different stories.
Correct.
What do you think connects these stories?
I tried to connect in several ways. The monastery figures is the central part of the first story, and there's references to it all the way, even the last story. The monks are a thread through the whole story. The supernatural aspects are threads to the whole story as well. There's the daughter of one person who is in one story, and then her mother is in another story, and so they are connected somehow.
Both through the land and in some cases through heritage.
Yes, that's right.
Well, Paul Salsini, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake
Effect. Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it very much.
Paul Salsini is the author of numerous books about the Tuscany region of Italy, including his latest, The Ghosts of the Garfagnana, Seven Strange Stories from Haunted Tuscany. Salsini spoke with Joy Powers, and he'll be at Boswell Book Company for an event next Monday at 7. You can find more information at wuwm.com. We'll take another break, and then Radio Chipstone explores the 19th century practice of object lessons. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Contributor Jennifer Field's mission has been to invite you to take a second look at the things you choose to keep near. That's the basis of material culture. Its purpose is not to look at the history of objects, but rather to look at history through objects. Material culture might seem like a new thing, but object lessons have been around since the 1800s. Sarah Ann Carter is a visiting scholar at the School of Human Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is the author of Object Lessons, How 19th Century Americans Learned to Make Sense of the Material World. In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Carter and contributor Jennifer Fields talk about the history of object lessons and how it helped school-aged children develop the ability to make sense of the world.
The idea behind object lessons was that children would learn best through their senses, through what they could touch and feel and smell and taste, rather than just memorizing words or learning abstract ideas through language. The idea was that through engaging with actual material things, through engaging with the world around them, children would learn how to think, how to reason, how to understand the world and their place in it, and not just parrot back things they had memorized, but to truly be thinking beings in the world.
How were children guided through learning through these objects?
As I talk about in the larger book about object lessons, there's a long history to this process and practice, but as it became used most commonly in the United States in the second half of the 19th century, there was this five-step method that really was at the heart of the object lesson. The first step was observation, really engaging with a material thing, looking closely, touching it, having a full sensory experience of that object. The second step was thinking about objects for their qualities. What is a quality of this object? What makes this what it is? How do we describe this object through its material qualities? The next step might be, what are qualities of this thing that we can't get just through the senses? So perhaps you might start with a hunk of ginger and you understand its material qualities. You might describe its smell or its taste or what it feels like. But then in the next step, you begin to think about what are qualities we can't get at just through its physical nature. What are abstract qualities that we might bring to this object? The fourth step is really sorting, thinking about what category might this object fit into? How do we understand this object's place in the world? if we were starting with something like ginger, it would be perhaps a spice or a food or something from far away or something grown in a particular way. If it was something like a cloth, how is it made? What is it used for? We could begin to sort it in that way. And then finally, the fifth step of an object lesson was writing about it. So some of these early object lessons really became composition exercises that taught children how to go from object, from material thing, to idea. And so the object lesson process really helps us think about how material things really engage with histories of ideas and have their own intellectual history as well.
So was this a radical idea for the time? And if so, how did the public, how's the community welcome, did they welcome this idea or this pedagogy of teaching?
The object lesson idea really grew out of 18th century European romantic pedagogy. So this idea that children were these feeling, sensing beings moving in the world. They weren't just beings to parrot back information. So you might think of someone like Rousseau or Pestalozzi, who really, his writing really became the foundation. Johann Heinrich Pestalozzi's writing really became the foundation for object lessons. And Pestalozzi wrote about something called Anschauungsunterricht, which in German means sense perception exercises, this idea that you have to train children's senses. So initially, this was something that was pretty radical. It was a way of really thinking about how children were moving and feeling in the world. Then this method was taken up by a whole range of pedagogues in the 19th century and then becomes really popular in the United States in the 1860s when it was adopted by a man named E.A. Sheldon who ran a normal school. And he realized that his students just weren't learning in a thorough way. He realized they were just learning for the test. They were not actually learning concepts, which is something that's pretty familiar to a lot of us today, right? Children were just learning to pass these exams, but that doesn't mean they were understanding. And so Sheldon, who was interested in pedagogy, he was researching what was happening in the world and other places, decided to bring this method of object lessons to New York, to his normal school, to a school that was training teachers. And within that school that was training teachers, he trained teachers in this method. He brought a teacher who was a specialist in object lessons from England to help him do that. And then those teachers who they trained brought the object lesson method to schools across the United States. So in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s, as you begin to look through school reports, which are the documents of what's being taught in different schools, and I look through many for this book, you actually see object lessons, object study listed as subjects that students are studying and engaging with, just as they're learning mathematics or reading.
What would one of these lessons have looked like?
So there were lots of ways that object lessons were brought into the classroom. So for example, you might start with something like sugar. You might bring in a large chunk of sugar. And the idea would be students would have to engage with this material to try to understand it. They would look closely at it. They might taste it. They might smell it, touch it, understand it's something that crumbles. Is it fusible? It burns. They're actually surviving lesson plans. And if you could imagine having, you know, a class of seven-year-olds tasting sugar, touching sugar, burning sugar, smelling it, but really saying, what is this substance that I see every day? How does it work? How do I understand this? So getting the material qualities, but then they would learn quite explicitly, where does this come from? Where did this grow? What kind of labor produced this? How did this get here? Learning that information from outside of that substance, right? Then they would sort it, figure out, well, what does this connect to? Yes, this is a food. This is a granular. This is maybe imported. You know, what kind of labor practices are being used here. And then they would think about how could they write about it, how you would start from these material experiences with this sugar to actually writing a composition. But the idea here is that you would really start with a substance, whether it's something like sugar, it could also be a produced substance like a pair of scissors or a thimble, a piece of porcelain, it could be any range of fabrics, it could be a book, there are object lessons on books, where children were taught not necessarily about what's in the book, but about the book as a material thing. How is it made? Where does it come from? What is this thing that I'm holding in my hand? And these lessons allowed children to really think about everything around them as having a story, as having a range of stories embedded in it, and to understand where those things come from and how those things were part of this complicated world in which they were living in.
So was there any pushback to this method?
There was. There were some educators who thought that the object lesson method was just another form of memorization. They thought that children aren't really engaging with these material things. They're just memorizing words to connect to these objects. But of course, that might be a case in which an object lesson isn't being used well, right? So that critique is out there for any pedagogical method, that in fact students aren't really learning. But it's hard to assess learning in the historic classroom, just as it's hard to really assess learning in our own classrooms in the 21st century. Some of those critiques might be valid, but the method was incredibly successful in terms of how quickly it spread through the country. And we also see its success in the way that the object lesson idea becomes a key part of the way 19th century Americans talk about the meanings objects have, in terms of things like the tariff debates of the 1890s, for example. The object lesson idea is part of the way people talk about those commodities in their histories. The object lesson idea becomes a key way to talk about museums, becomes a key way to talk about objects for sale in department stores. There are ads which feature object lessons as a way to understand the meaning of a commodity or a material thing. So while it's difficult to assess how that lesson might have been successful for any particular student, it becomes a key way 19th century Americans talk about material things, really talk about this very material world of the late 19th century.
Contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. She spoke with Sarah Ann Carter, a visiting scholar in design and material culture studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her book is called Object Lessons: How 19th Century Americans Learned to Make Sense of the Material World. We will take one last break and then meet the co-creators of a new comedy web series, Shangri-La. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM right after this. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Bonnie North. Shangri-La, a fictionalized paradise on Earth where happiness is permanent and you're isolated from the world. Well, that's probably vastly different compared to the setting of a new web series, which is also called Shangri-La. Wisconsin natives Nick Summer and Drew Rosas co-created the episodic comedy project. It follows an ensemble cast of characters trying to make it in Hollywood while surviving on the streets of Los Angeles. Rosas and Summers joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio ahead of a screening tomorrow night at the Cooperage. Rosas starts by explaining how their own experience of going west after graduating from UWM's film school influenced the premise of this web series.
The concept really came, I think, from sort of the transplanting ourselves from the Midwest out to California and Los Angeles and being sort of thrown into the monster of the entertainment industry. And there's this fascinating phenomenon you run into out there. There's obviously a lot of transient people and people that end up kind of like living off the streets or in various forms of survival. And the one thing I didn't expect was that as I'd meet various people or come across them on our productions and journeys and such, we found a lot of people that were former industry people that had sort of came out to Los Angeles or grew up there or whatever reason, had a shot at the industry, and it didn't quite work out, or they're still trying to make it, and they had kind of like found themselves at the street level of Los Angeles. And I thought that was just so fascinating. I never really thought about that before, that you have this giant monster of a machine that's sort of chewing people up and spitting them back out.
And we looked in the mirror and we found ourselves in the exact same place. Right. And we thought, hey, let's make a story about our lives. You know, filmmakers trying to struggle to make it in Los Angeles or Milwaukee. We're both graduates from UW-Milwaukee, and I actually live back here now. But during this project, we were both out in L.A. trying to do a new thing. And so we came up with this series idea and just kind of grew from there.
What do you think of the idea that, you know, go west, my people, you know, to accomplish, especially in, it seems like, artistic fields? Everyone thinks like the West is the place to be, in L.A. or, you know, Hollywood in particular, of course. What were your concepts of it before you guys moved out there yourself? And then how do you view it differently after creating this project and just experiencing it for yourselves?
Yeah, there's definitely a mythology of Los Angeles and Hollywood that is this fascination for a lot of people, especially from around the world, around the country. You know, it attracts a lot of creative people that think, oh, that's where you got to be. In reality, in today's interconnected world, you can kind of do it from anywhere. The only thing that I think that city really offers you is access to people and companies that you might not have here. But you don't quite need that anymore to quite break out, in a sense. So there is this mythology there, and that was really what we kind of want to tap into with the show, is sort of take the mythology of Shangri-La, the original Tibetan utopia, and flip it on its head and say, okay, what about the myth of Hollywood and that mirage? Is that still exist, and sort of have a comedy that sort of poke fun at it and the absurdities that come along with that?
Right. And on that note, how about you guys just give us a brief overall picture of what Shangri-La is about?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Shangri-La is essentially following a group of lovable characters trying to make it in Hollywood while struggling on the streets of Los Angeles. That's just like the short pitch of it. So essentially, we have characters playing actors. One of them is a Jewish pop star. There's a filmmaker who's also a manager, who's also a producer, who's also a writer. Basically, that character is similar to Drew and I struggle, and so we kind of poke fun at him, and he's just always, they're all sort of scheming to find their way, and we compare it to sort of like a show like Girls, or even I bring up Friends, where they all kind of live in these nice apartments, and you're just, it's so unrealistic, which it's fine, and those shows are fantastic, but we wanted to get a little grittier and a little more realistic, and, you know, have characters that live in cars, or live in a garage, or, you know, live off the land. Like my character, he used to be a small-time infomercial host, but he has these flashbacks to that character. And you jump forward about 1 year is where the series begins, and now he has a huge beard, really long hair. He builds a shack that overlooks the L.A. skyline, and he calls that his paradise, and he's living off the land. He'd consider himself a wilderness man who lives off the land, but his land is Los Angeles. And that's why our character sort of, you know, travels through and meets these curious individuals who are also finding themselves on the struggle. They're all trying to climb their way up, and he's kind of been there, and it wasn't his paradise of Shangri-La.
And you two created the premise of the show together. What made you think you were the right guy to be one of the characters?
Convenience, probably.
Yeah.
Well, it's a couple of things. I mean, one, it is really, really helpful when you're writing a show with someone to put them as the lead actor, because then I can make him do anything because he helped write it. You know,
it's true.
Yeah, we already know going into it. Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and Nick does all kinds of ridiculous stuff in this series. You know, from taking a shower in a cooler on top of a hilltop, or does his own stunts, like several jump and fly moves. But he used to be a skateboarder, so he's very good at the rollout.
Yeah, there's another scene where I actually wash my face in the LA River, and for people in Los Angeles, realize how pretty disgusting and dirty that is. Can't really write that in because the way we shot it, it'd be impossible to fake it. And so I'm just like, all right, man, we're going for it. Like, we know I'm going to do it, so just let's plan it. And also, Drew and I have been working. We made several features together, and it's how we originally worked on a project where the original actor fell through, and he ended up casting me, and that's how we became really good friends. And I started helping even more with art department and stuff. And we've been making projects ever since. So it helps a lot when you have one character already in it, ready to go. And
that's a production advantage to working with a partner. But there's also a character element, I think, that really ties in the sense Nick and I have had many conversations about work, money, life, and sort of like, where do you align the balance of how much time you want to spend working your job versus how much time you want to spend living your life? And making films like this is really a passion project. And we're not making a ton of money on these. We're putting everything we have into them, all of our time and sweat. So there's this balance, and it is a conversation that we've had for many years about how many days do you want to, you know, give up to your 9-to-5 versus be an artist, a creative, or just,
all of them. I'll give up all my 9-to-5s.
Well, Nick has always had a policy. He likes to work the least amount possible in a given year just to survive. And so there is a certain element of frugality that comes into his lifestyle that taps into that character as well.
It has a premise of following just, quote, lovable losers. You know, make a show about nobodies. Do you think that audiences nowadays do want more content about people who are genuinely struggling?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
it's less escapist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this show is really You have people that are struggling at this one level, but in Los Angeles, everyone's climbing the same ladder in the industry. And you might get a big break and take one step up that ladder, but then you're just looking at the next rung. And you're still kind of, you have the same feeling, same sensibility. That story has been told a million times over. So we kind of wanted to find a vantage point that hadn't really been shown before. And that's why we said, hey, what if we were just at the bottom of the ladder looking up at everyone? And what would that story be?
Along with just practicality, production value, frugality. This is a real kind of process of DIY filmmaking. So can you touch upon that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, we obviously with today's technology and everything, it's so much easier to get things done and to make them happen. A lot of times Drew and I might be the only ones out shooting. Like if I'm, it's another perk to me being one of the central characters is he might be running the audio and the camera gear himself. And Drew also shot the entire thing. It looks amazing. Like he has a nice camera. And obviously we're film students, so the composition usually works well, and I do a lot of art stuff. So yeah, it gives us the ability at the independent level to make everything and actually make it look. That's like one of the things we've had during these screenings of our tour is afterwards people who are show up who don't know us are surprised, and they're just like, wow, no, that looked like a real show. And we're like, yeah, it is a real show. But when you hear web series, you automatically think, oh, you know, I've seen things on the web, whatever, which is part of the reason we wanted to do the tour to begin with, is make it a big event, make it fun, and get people out to actually realize, hey, we're making beautiful-looking content that, you know, hopefully is also entertaining.
Yeah, we've arrived at this strange place in the independent film timeline where the technology has arrived at a very cheap level. You can, I mean, the camera I used to shoot the entire show myself, you can get now for under $1,000, a couple lenses, and sound equipment. Everything's really, really affordable. So it's kind of the democratization of the technology and the filmmaking process, as well as the distribution platforms, which with the internet and streaming content, everything is sort of arriving at the same time at this new frontier. And so there's advantages to that so that anybody can go out and create with limited resources. You can just go make stuff. If you have a great idea and you have a little bit of technical skills, you can actually just go do it. At the same time, it's sort of we're entering this realm where the viewership is just flooded, or the content on the web is completely flooded, and you're in this new struggle now where it's like you can have really great stuff, but you have to figure out a way to kind of swim above the rest and, you know, tread water and find your little niche. And so it allows for certain advantages, but also provides a new sort of hurdle to overcome.
Right, and you guys are approaching just getting the word out in a unique way with essentially a Midwest tour of a web series. Now, often we associate tours with musicians, shows, things like that. So what made you want to approach it in this way to get out and see people? You know, despite it being available on streaming services, you know, by definition, can be seen anywhere with anyone doing anything. So why did you want to harness this additional audience connection?
Yeah, there's something really disconnected about the web. You know, you are very connected, but you're not seeing that human interaction. And especially with a comedy, so much of the satisfaction of it is putting it on a big screen in a theater with people and blowing their minds and getting to witness that reaction, as well as just making that person-to-person contact. You know, the music scene is a good example, and what we kind of trying to emulate that in this tour and say, hey, if we were an indie band going on tour, we could play this venue, we could do this one. But for us, it's a web series, and they're just independent theaters that we're crisscrossing the country with. And yeah, I don't know.
Well, we're also used to screening on the big screen. It's like you take this all this time with the feature films we've made. That's your goal, right? As you take, you know, 2.5 years, and with this project, 4 years, because it's even more content. All this time, it's all this buildup, and then you get to have this one premiere, and then, which is fantastic. You get all this excited energy, you see your friends, you meet new people. And then with this one, we're like, okay, it's a web series, so it's going to go online. And then there's this disconnect, and we're just like a little disappointed where you don't get to have that event. And we just said, why not? Like, let's do it. It's, you know, 2 hours and 15 minutes. It's a long feature, and we do an intermission for our things. So it's even more time to mingle and meet people. And it's just like this fun buildup to this event and excited energy. And I think, I guess the whole point is when you do that and you meet people, that's just such a better way to help try and spread your story, spread your project to other people, meeting them in person versus like, you should really like this online or on my Facebook page, and which is like ridiculous. There's a huge disconnect there. So I think it's always better to meet people in person, go out in public. And like Drew was saying, it's way more fun when you go out and you watch something in a theater on a big screen when you're dealing with a comedy.
We're trying every angle we can to sort of break through the noise.
Now, with one of the characters, Nikki Kaplow, played by you, Nick, there's a quote that he says, "Jobs are for people who want what they don't already have." So, you know, lots of these random tidbits of wisdom from your character and other characters in the series. I was wondering, do you guys have favorites that show up throughout this first season? And how much of it is just over-exemplifying Nikki's mindset and where this character is in life? And how much is it you guys putting your little two cents in, having been here, moved out west to pursue the artist's dream, and then have this, you know, probably more down-to-earth view about it?
Yeah, I really do like the combination of having jokes intermixed with these deeper moments. And even the deeper moments, they might provide a certain bit of wisdom, but they're also funny in sort of the way that they're brought to the screen. And one of the characters that does that the best for us is the Mark Borchardt character, who sort of acts as Nikki Kaplow's guru, his guiding light in the streets of Los Angeles. And I don't know, he has a couple lines about, you know, the working man trades 20,000 days of servitude in exchange for their retirement. And to me, that is really, we just did the math on that. And we said, hey, if you worked a 9-to-5 and you did this and then you wanted, you know, this many years, you hit your retirement, how many days is that? Like, nobody really thinks about that. You sign the contract, you join the job, and you know, submit your application. But they don't tell you, like, okay, you know, if you really follow this through the end, that's going to be 20,000 days that you give to this company. And that's kind of fascinating and mind-blowing when you think about it. And you start to realize why someone might trade instead of giving those 20,000 days, take them back into their own life. You might live by less means, but at least you'll be in control of your own freedom.
Yeah, exactly. Like, basically, my character and, of course, the Borchardt character, the Nikki Kaplow character that I play, is a lot what Drew and I talk about. It's like, how are you spending your time? Like he mentioned and we talked about earlier, is like, is it the 9-to-5-er? Which, of course, everyone needs money to live. I get that. I understand. But at the same point, if you broke it down, like I said earlier, to a wilderness man who's living off the land, you know, they would just say, all right, let's figure out a way where I don't, like, my job is my life. I'm just living it day to day, which is sort of like the hippie mentality, right? Is like, you just, freedom is time. It's not necessarily money, and you can't buy that time back. So that's one of the things we find in my character. And then also all the characters are sort of a little self-reflexive on themselves. Everyone who acts in this is also one of our friends. And so we would have meetings, we'd have discussions, and we'd sort of cater their character to their lifestyle. So that's how the characters, when they improvise or whatever, come off a little bit more original.
Well, Drew and Nick, thank you both so much for coming in to talk about Shangri-La. I hope audiences here love it. It's well done and time well spent.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Nick Sommer and Drew Rosas are the co-creators of the new comedy web series Shangri-La. They'll both be at the Cooperage tomorrow evening for a screening of the first season as part of their 2019 Midwest tour. On Monday evening, they'll be giving a live commentary along with a screening at No Studios. You can find out more about both screenings at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.